When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The official Brighton and Hove Albion podcast.
Welcome to the official Brighton and Hove Albion podcast with me, Paul Hayward. No Glenn this week, but don't worry, he'll be back soon. Today we have the privilege of speaking to a remarkable individual whose resilience and courage has left an enduring mark on those around him, Ephraim Brynan. In the aftermath of the unimaginable loss of his son James, Ephraim embarked on a path of healing and self-discovery, demonstrating the resilience of the human spirit. And now, through his charity Strong Men, he has become a source of inspiration for countless individuals navigating their own personal challenges. In our conversation today, we'll explore Ephraim's remarkable journey from the reality TV show that saved his life to losing his son James in Afghanistan. James himself was an avid Albion fan who is memorialized at the club through the James Brynan Fan of the Season Award. Ephraim, welcome.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for having me.
To recap, your son James was an avid Albion fan who lost his life in Afghanistan in October 2013. We'll talk about all that later, but in the meantime, it's important to say that the Fan of the Season Award is named after James, and in the light of his death, in the wake of his death, you started a charity called Strong Men to help other people in your situation, and indeed in many other situations to do with bereavement and personal struggle. They say bereavement is a process, not an event. So more than a decade on from James's death, where are you now in that process?
That's a good question. I mean, it's right, this week is difficult. So we lost our dog 2 days ago, which was horrendous because we'd had Zach, the dog, since James, so he was 13. James died 10 years ago. So he was a connection to the past. So right, this week has been a difficult week. And it always seems weird when people say it's just a dog, but sometimes it's what they have around them and it's the empty spaces and all that stuff. So this week has been a challenge. But taking that to one side and moving into last week, maybe as an example, it is a process that's ebbed and flowed. It's always a work in progress. Sometimes there are reminders, permanent reminders. I mean, James will always be 22. And when you see his friends who are now 30, 32, 33, and where they are and what's happened in between, it's a vast period of time. It's a decade. It's almost 50% of the time he was around. He was 22 when he died and he's been dead 10 and a half years. So I don't ever really know where I am with it. As a family, we are as close as we've ever been. We always have been really close. So I had James when I was 18, so I was very young. My wife, as she is now, and James's mum was 17 when she fell pregnant. And we had our second child, our daughter Yasmin, when I was 20 and Sharon was 19. So James really was a massive part of my life from being a child myself at 18. So to lose him so suddenly and unexpectedly, whilst he was in Afghanistan, it was a dangerous war zone. He was one of 10,000 troops. So we always thought, you know, we've got a 10,000 to one chance of being okay. Unfortunately, as we know in life, it doesn't work that way. So the shock of it took a long time to clear. And I was in a haze and a muddle for a very long time after that, just trying to really work out what I wanted to do, where I was, the impact that it had. I had quite a senior job at the time, which I carried on with for a while, but that became too difficult for me to do so. I was diagnosed with prostate cancer three years after James died. So I had to have my prostate removed. And then it was really, do you know what, time to make a bit of a lifestyle change. I did the TV show SAS Who Dares Wins in 2016, I think it was. I met a guy called Dan through that. Dan's wife had been murdered. We wanted to put something together. We didn't really know what it was at the time, just based on what we'd experienced. So I'm not saying we looked for support, because a lot of times when you lose someone, it's just a process of life. It's not necessarily something you think you can get help for, because you can't change it. So, but what you can get is support from people who've been through similar things. And particularly with me being something that was unexpected, I contacted Cruise Bereavement Support, for example, because I thought, you know, I probably could do with seeing someone, because this was after I was diagnosed with cancer and I didn't really care that I had cancer, if I'm honest. If someone had a heart monitor on me, it probably didn't miss a beat. And people always say the worst thing you can ever be told is you have cancer. Well, it absolutely isn't. The worst thing that could happen to me was James dying, and that had happened. So I didn't really care. It's not to say I wanted to die, but I wasn't afraid of dying, and I was in a fairly probably unhealthy place with death in that respect. In that it's like the thing, well, if I die, at least I can hopefully see James again. Not that I'm a religious man, but you have to have some sort of hope and belief in life, or else what's the point? There has to be some sort of process for it. So I'm meandering a little bit, but the point behind that was it would be great to speak to people in a similar situation to me. So my wife went to a SAFRA event. She enjoyed speaking to other mums who'd lost children in conflict. I had the opportunity to speak to the dads, and it was really nice. It gave me a real release. It wasn't like, even when you're sat in a room like this, you're the odd one out. It's a bit of an elephant in the room. It's an uncomfortable thing for people to talk about. They don't even know if they should talk about it. So to know that everyone else in the room has gone through a similar thing was great. So we wanted to put something together like that. There's not many places you can go for that support. So we set Strong Men up.
Okay, we'll come back to Strong Men in a moment, but I think I just need to spell out just the basic details of what happened to James. Lance Corporal James Brynin was an intelligence corps soldier in Helmand Province. In the early hours of the 15th of October, he left Camp Bastion on an intelligence operation in Helmand Province and lost his life in a firefight. Now, I know it's football is trivial by comparison, but I've seen a picture of him holding up a Brighton and Hove Albion flag. And I know that his love of Brighton and football was very strong and part of his life. And I just wonder whether, is there still a connection for you there? Something to give you a positive association? I know it's a small thing, but does it still count?
It does. It makes a massive difference. James was a fan. I mean, James went to Gillingham to watch Brighton. He was a season ticket holder at the Wythe Dean. He went to a lot of the cup games. He loved it. It was a great thing for him. So he played football. He represented the county. He got up to England schools and colleges trials. He played against Chris Smalling in a game for Horsham about Maidstone, which was always bizarre. You think the different courses their lives have taken, literally like that. And that's fate, I guess, and luck, and good luck and bad luck. But yeah, football's a huge part. Was a huge part of his life. He played from about 5 or 6 up until when he died at 22. And he was a massive fan of Brighton. It was a big thing for him. He took the flag with him on every operation. It went with him. He sent one tweet out. It was the day before he died, which was the flag at their forward operating base before they went on the operation that he would eventually die in. So it's very poignant. And literally the day after he died, which seemed bizarre. So for us, it's really nice. I mean, we were contacted by a lot of people when James died, offering to do certain things, you know, anything as silly as having a road named after him or the Civic Centre in Shoreham. But that just wasn't him. He was very understated, didn't want to make a big fuss of stuff. So we had to choose the right thing. And when the club contacted us and said, look, after a few, I can't remember how long it was, but after a while, it's like, we've been thinking about it. We want to do something that's more permanent. We'd like to have the James Brynin Supporter of the Year Award named in his honour. It's like, absolutely, it's perfect. Absolutely perfect. And the only other thing we've put his names to is Sussex Schools FA have a player of the season that they use. And those are the only two things, really, that we've ever put his name to, because they're the only appropriate things. We could have done loads of things, and sometimes you think maybe we should have, because as time passes and fewer people know about him, his name sometimes gets lost. But this is a huge thing for us as a family. We come to the awards each year, which is great. And it's nice to see the people who win the awards. And hopefully they then take a bit of time to see, what is this award? What is this name? What does it represent? So for us, it's a massive thing. And we hope that it continues, you know, for as long as possible.
In this training ground here, we're used to talking about the personal qualities of young people. And I was reading some of the tributes to James from colleagues. A star burning bright and rising fast, extraordinary courage, generally recognised to be at the top of his peer group. He thrived on being in the thick of the action. I mean, these are very fulsome tributes. And I wonder, did he display those qualities very early in life? He sounds like an exceptional young man.
He did. We brought both our children up to do that. I think it's the greatest thing when you can look back on to see how your children have grown up and matured, and you've raised them that way, and then hopefully they raise their children that way. So James displayed great courage and leadership from an early age. Generally speaking, he was the captain of the teams he was in. He played up a year at school, represented the sixth form when he was in the year below. He was very vocal, but he would always expect people to have the same commitment as him, which doesn't always happen, which could sometimes be frustrating for him. As he played higher with football, so when the counties in particular, obviously it's a given then that they're all good players, but their mentality wasn't always as wholesome as his. It wasn't always, not always as determined as his. So when he died, and when we read some of the reports, because we've seen all the footage of how he died, lots of tributes, a huge amount of paperwork when we went through the inquest procedure, everything he did would be what I expected him to do. And if he knew he was going to die, I still think he would do it exactly the same. It would have made no difference to him, which is probably the greatest tribute that I can give, that he knew he had to do the right thing is what he did. He was mentioned in dispatches for his courage at the time. Everyone that was around him has spoken really highly about him and how he performed in that situation, which, you know, it's like no other situation. It's nothing like anything else. You know, when someone's trying to kill you, that's very different from a normal day-to-day, even a job as bizarre as being a professional sports person. It's totally different when someone's trying to kill you. And to display that sort of courage, I think, is remarkable. But it's the same with my daughter. So when James died, she joined the army. She did her period in the army. She then trained as a paramedic. She came and worked here in the medical department. She was one of very few females in the medical department. She then went and did a master's degree in osteopathy. She'd done a paediatrics extension to that. Now, when James died, she was doing retail sales in Bentalls or Beals. Very, very different. And I think when he died, I think it changed her. And she had to find a bit of a connection there somewhere. But it changed her. I'm so proud of both my children. Neither one more than the other. They're both remarkable people. And we hope now that my daughter's become a mum and I've become a granddad, that she'll do the same with her children. I'm sure she will. She'll raise them in the right way. And I think if more people took that sort of attitude, then I think the world would probably be a much better place than it is at the moment.
Yeah, indeed. And a year before the inquest into James's death, you appeared as recruit number 11 in Channel 4's SAS Who Dares Wins in Ecuador. And I wondered why you were keen to take part in that.
I get asked this question a lot, and I still don't have an answer for it. It's not really me. As I said earlier, that James is very understated. Generally speaking, I am. Now, when we watched the first series, it was filmed round Broadie, where James was based, so a lot of the places we went to were shown on that show. So I felt like we had a bit of a connection to it, and it was kind of drawing me in. So I just applied for it, didn't think anything of it. And then I'm literally at Heathrow Airport with 24 other blokes heading out to Ecuador to do the show. I had some healthcare issues while I was in there, and that's how I found out I had prostate cancer. If I hadn't have gone on that show, I probably wouldn't have found it, and I will probably be dead now. So, again, I'm not a religious person, but it kind of feels a bit weird to me that happened and that was found as a result of it. So the biggest gift that I could have got out of it was finding out I had prostate cancer and being treated for it, and touch wood, being clear of it 6 years later. So that's the biggest thing I got out of it. I think I probably... if I'm honest, it just really happened. I never thought that it would happen. And even when I was stood there at the airport, I was kind of like, well, that sort of escalated pretty quickly. I went through all the physical examinations, the psychological examinations, the health examinations, all of these things, and just kept going on to the next stage and the next stage. Every stage thinking that I'd get culled because I was old, way beyond the age of most of the guys, were in their mid-20s. But it was a great experience to get to abseil out of a helicopter over the Amazon and stuff like that. Was brilliant. It was just a great experience.
I dare say there are a few NDAs involved in going on that show, but is it as tough as it looks, or is it, how much of it is stage managed for TV and how much of it is like being in the SAS?
Well, I don't think it's ever like being in the SAS, because no one's trying to kill you. So the biggest part of that is, again, weapons handlings and that sort of thing. But it is brutal. You know, anything as simple as you go from Heathrow to Madrid, from Madrid to Quito, so you've got jet lag issues. There is no acclimatisation. The humidity was about 95% to 98%. You've got things trying to kill you, spiders, snakes. Even the trees have got spikes on. The jungle comes to life at night. There's a lot of stuff that gets filmed and never gets used because it's dark. You're in the jungle. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. It doesn't really make good telly, but they just relentlessly come at you all the time. One of the guys got bitten by a tarantula in the first half, and the first thing we did, and he went into anaphylactic shock. A guy broke his ankle. All sorts of stuff happens. There is not, or there wasn't, they probably changed a huge amount. I mean, for example, the first thing we did is we jumped off a bridge, a 10 meter high bridge, into a fast flowing river without life jackets. There was no divers down there. There was just a couple of guys in boats. You literally hit the water, you go under the water, you can't even see your hand in front of your head, you resurface, and then you swim to the boat. That river was known as Anaconda River because they have anacondas in it. And an hour before we get there, the Ecuadorian army just released hand grenades into it, which apparently scares them off. And then you do your thing. But that thing took about 3 hours to film because they had to shut the road every time. So when we knew after, it's like, well, surely they come back when they realise nothing's going to happen. So if even if you caught a log and got stuck down there, they would never have found you, which I found absolutely bizarre. And then a lot of the guys got sunstroke going from the boats to the where we were based. And because it's the jungle, they have cesspits because that's how they live out there. And as it floods, the cesspits run into the rivers. And as you go in the rivers, you swim with all sorts and your hands get infected. So, for example, my fingernails all got infected. I couldn't do my shoelaces up or my trousers up. Someone had to dress me. Stuff like that you don't get to see on TV. Because, you know, and again, that side of it, we were fed once a day. They just had the earthquake over there. The Zika virus was live in Brazil. All sorts of stuff was going on and none of the supply got through. So we were supposed to have a wet kit and a dry kit. We had one kit. So you sleep in the wet, you get up in the wet. So you never change to the dry. Sand infections all in your private parts. I mean, it was disgusting.
Well, I think that answers my question about whether it's stage managed.
But don't let it put you off.
No wonder they tend to do it in Scotland or wherever now.
The official Brighton and Hove Albion podcast.
And I know when you told your SAS handlers what had happened to James and why you were on the show, because there was this question mark about your age and why you were there. They understood it and they were highly emotional, weren't they, when you told them that story?
They were, and they didn't know. They definitely didn't know. I could just tell. And a lot of what we spoke about never got shown because it was probably a half an hour conversation that gets edited down to maybe a couple of minutes for TV. But for me, once I'd spoken about that, that exhausted me. It kind of, the mental release of just speaking about it and knowing that it would be on TV. I think I'm done now. I think that's me tapping out, really, irrespective of all the other stuff that had happened. Once that had happened, it just was like, well, I'm just exhausted. But they were great, and I still keep in contact with a couple of the guys, with Billy. I saw him a couple of weeks ago up in London, and Foxy maybe last week saw him up in Birmingham. So really good guys. It was just a wonderful experience, and to watch it back was uncomfortable because it's like I mean, I'm sure you don't like listening to yourself speaking when you listen to it. Do I really sound like that? To watch it back on telly was very uncomfortable. And weird that people, even to this day, just say, Birmingham at the weekend before last, like, were you? It's weird. It's just a weird thing for me. But I'm glad I did it. I would be dead if I didn't do it. It's a great experience. And like all of these things now, when James died, all of us were of the impression that life's too short. You're here for a visit. It's not about money. It's about experiences, good and bad. Get out there and do it. And it was an amazing experience, and I enjoyed every moment of it.
And was it cathartic in any way? Did it help you connect with James and his experience in the military?
I think it did a little bit in that we never knew what was going to happen. So you know that feeling you get in your stomach sometimes that's raw. People now call it anxiety, but it's just apprehension, nerves, the unknown, which is a healthy reaction to have. You know, your body should be like that. I think that's probably similar to what he maybe felt when they went out on operations, especially as, you know, as someone, he was on his second tour, but some of the guys that were out there had been on numerous tours, so he would be relatively inexperienced in that sort of side of things. So it was nice to get that feeling, and the feeling of like, you know, this is brutal.
And from all of this has come the Strong Men charity. So it's called Strong Men, but it's not only for men, is it?
It is. No, we're a men's bereavement charity.
Right.
We wanted to do something that was just for men.
Yeah.
Purely because there are a lot of bereavement support services available, which are predominantly tailored towards women, because women are just better at looking for support. So we wanted something that's run by men for men.
The term strong men is interesting because that suggests resilience, but you're encouraging men to display vulnerability, aren't you, and to open up at the same time.
Yeah, to help build that resilience. So you have to have resilience in life. There are going to be things that happen to you which are difficult. whoever you are, they are, and you have to be able to build that resilience. What this provides is somewhere to go when you need support from people who've been through similar things. So I think a problem shared is definitely a problem halved. It makes a massive difference. And what we're doing is not rocket science. It's just providing a nice platform for people to be able to talk safely away from their families, away from their friends, away from the situations where, you know, people know you at work as a certain person. They wouldn't necessarily want you to be a vulnerable, talk about stuff that's very, very difficult, makes you vulnerable, particularly if, you know, if you work for maybe in the military or the police force, you know, you don't want a sergeant talking about something like this and you're under, it just makes things hard. So if you can go away somewhere completely different, that's safe and secure and speak in confidence, that's what we wanted to provide. So it's that little link to other guys with the similar thing, and it creates this little brotherhood, and that's what we wanted to do, and it's been really, really successful.
So you offer, you know, one-to-one support, weekenders, and talks. You've spoken in prisons, you've spoken in all sorts of places, haven't you?
Mm.
And what's the essence of your message?
Well, the essence of my message is that I'm a normal person that's been through extraordinary things. I think it's all very well and good when you get some, you know, again, a lot of people like a former sports person that come in and they talk about how they triumphed over adversity, and it's great, but it's not really relevant to most of us. I think from my side, I'm talking about, I was just bumbling along doing the average 9 to 5, doing pretty well, had a lovely family, and then all of a sudden it just went out the window and everything changed. And I had to continue to do the best I could with it, all the different things. So the focus on that really is just how lucky I was in the situation with the James. So me and him were in a good place. We didn't fall out. We were in a really healthy relationship with each other. So I never felt that guilt, or I never had any regret in that respect. So it's really just to share troubles, talk about stuff, be more open. That's really the message of the talks. And hopefully it inspires people a little bit, because, you know, as I say, I speak about the cancer, 1 in 2 will get cancer of some form, and speaking about some of the symptoms of that and how you manage that process. And also when you survive cancer, people think that's it, you're done. It's not like that at all. It changes you. Something like prostate cancer, there's a physical and an emotional change in you as well, which as a younger person doesn't get spoken about. So it's nice to be able to speak to people who've been through a similar thing. Now, since I had my cancer, I've spoken to maybe 10 or 15 guys of a similar age that have been through that. Got a couple of people at the moment, and they can ask you proper information, you know, not from a doctor who is very highly technically trained, but the actual common sense stuff goes out the window. They can talk to you about stuff that's actually more relevant, and that's nice. So that's what that talk is all part of, and it runs alongside the charity. We take it into schools, prisons, corporates. Sometimes if we can make a bit of a funding out of it, which helps then fund the charity. And it's nice to get the message out there, and it brings James's message and everything that he's been through and we've been through as a family, as an organisation, to a new audience.
It must give you a perspective on sport as well, because we talk about heroism in relation to somebody scoring a hat-trick or taking a penalty under pressure. And you know, when you hear that kind of language about sport, you must sometimes think, well,
yeah, it's embarrassing.
When I think about what my son went through,
it's embarrassing. Yeah, I mean, it is. it really is. When you know, I understand it's sometimes things are difficult, but in any job, whatever it is that you do, you know, you're going home safe tonight most of the time. You know, there are very odd exceptions when that doesn't happen, but most of the time, it's not a matter of life or death. Every time James stepped out of the wire, it was a matter of life or death. People are trying to kill you, and it's difficult. And I've seen, you know, I don't think any of us know how we would react if something similar like that were to happen. You know, sometimes you have a near miss in the car and your heart's going and you've got dry breathing and, you know, all logic goes out the window. And that's just nothing compared to, you know, rounds flying past your head, bombs going off, IEDs, all these other things you're trying to think of, and then all the people around you. So, yeah, it's not even the same lifestyle. It's just not. Yeah, but I guess that's, you know, sports people, movie stars, singers, they are heroes because they inspire generations of people to do. Some people want to be like them, but the real heroes of the world we live in are your nurses, your doctors, your soldiers, your people that work for, you know, help people, for social, all of it. Those are the real heroes in life. And I think once you've been through something, you do realise that that is actually the case.
Yeah. So people listening to this, say they're coping with a terrible bereavement or some other crisis in their lives. What's the first thing you think they should do to start on the process of managing it, coping with it?
Problem is with this is everybody's different. Everyone reacts differently. Everyone has a different relationship for the person who died. A lot of people can, they don't need any support or help. They're quite happy as they are. And I totally understand that. I was a lot like that. It was only the cancer, I believe, was a stress relation to what I've been through and not particularly dealing with it. I'd sort of compartmentalized it, but I hadn't processed it and dealt with it. It was just sat there like a ticking time bomb. And it either gets you physically or mentally, but it will get you somewhere down the line, whether it's a year later, 2 years or whatever. So I think look for some advice, look for some support, read a lot of stuff, concentrate on yourself, have a look at yourself, see where you are with stuff. I mean, generally, you know, I knew I was very tired, finding concentration an issue, my memory had turned to stuff. I mean, my gums had started rotting, which I didn't know about. I had cancer. All of these things I knew nothing about until they were found. So I think look out there for help, read about stuff, get some knowledge on it. And if you do need support, then Strongmen is one of a number of organisations that can support you. To say we take groups of guys away, we camp, we do barbecue, we do activities, zip wiring, all sorts of great stuff. But we've also got the one-to-one peer-based support. We've got qualified level 4 counsellors that offer support as well for more complex needs, because, you know, irrespective of what it is, some people would think maybe losing a son is on the top Trump scale is worse than losing a parent to cancer in their 80s. It doesn't work like that. You know, that person could have a huge impact for you. I know when I die, all being well, the impact that will have on my, not all being well obviously, but in the normal structure of things, so I'll die before my daughter, but when I die it'll be a huge issue for her, because she really does rely on us because of what's happened to us as our family dynamic, and we're incredibly close and open and honest with it. So everybody's different. Don't feel that because you've lost an elderly relative to cancer or dementia that it's makes you any less likely to need support than me, having lost a son or a partner or whatever it happens to be. Everybody's different, and if you need support, you feel you need support, or just to talk to someone or get advice, then get it. It's so important. Don't leave it. Don't say I'll come back in a few weeks, months, because you don't. You just got to deal with it, and the impact it can have on you, it can be life changing.
Mm. So finally, the James Brynan Fan of the Season Award is quite a significant symbolic event in this club, isn't it? It very often rewards a fan who's displayed particular perseverance or courage, as somebody who might have come down from Preston for every game in a wheelchair. Yeah. There's always an element in that award, it seems to me, of courage. It's not just for being keen. You don't get it for being keen on the Albion, do you? Because everybody's keen on the Albion. So for you, it must be reassuring to see James's memory kept alive at the football club, and to be attached to a specific thing, and to be attached to something which really should go on forever, shouldn't it? It should always be there.
I hope so. It's the underdog sort of thing that we're looking at. So James was 5'8". I don't know, he was about 80 kilos, something like that. So he's a relatively small guy. And whenever he played football, some of these guys are massive. But it didn't make any difference. It was always, it's commitment, dedication. It's that, it's overcoming troubles, trial, resilience. It's all of these things that, you know, if I had to explain, I could write 10, 15 things and there would be little things like that. So that's what it's all about. But it is really important to us. So each year when we come along, we never know who's won it. We hope that the club's done their great work with which they have done with all the winners so far. And they've chosen well, and we generally know that it is. But for us, it's difficult. You know, we come along, it's all about celebrating. It's the players, it's the goals, it's the... But for us, it's deeper than that. It's kind of, we're coming here. James never got to come to the Amex. I mean, I took him round when I was in construction when the stadium was being built, and we got to have a look behind the scenes before the stadium was ever built. But he never got to see a game of football here. He never got to see Brighton in the Premier League. Hopefully one day England wins something, but he's never seen England. No, I haven't either, and I'm 52 this year, which is ridiculous, and surely this year. But all of these things, they're happy, but they're sad in the same way. I mean, I sometimes, when James was in Sharon's tummy, England were playing Cameroon in 1990. And I remember pulling my car to the side of the road because I couldn't listen. I had to leave the house and listen on the radio, pulled to the side of the road, stood in a phone box while the penalties were being taken by Lineker. And I'll always remember that James was, you know, he was a baby in Sharon's tummy at the time. So that connection is always really strong for me. Wouldn't expect that to be for anybody else, but football's such a massive part and always been such a massive part of his life. So we hope that the Albion carry on with the award for us as forever, or as long as we can do, because it is really nice for us. And it lets us know that people care. It lets us know that people still admire him. It lets us know that his memory and his name will live on. And hopefully it'll inspire another generation, you know, that he'll be a name always associated with the Albion, as a lot of the other well-known supporters and players and stuff are. Because, yes, he's not a player. He's not one of these sorts. But, you know, he was a hero to a lot of people, and he's changed a lot of people's lives. Those who served with him write to us every year, and the impact he had on really senior military people, really, really senior, is remarkable for a lad of such age. So that fills me with pride. Obviously, I'd rather have him back than any of that, and I'd rather he'd just gone into IT or something, but he was never going to do that. That just wasn't him. So it's a great legacy to have.
Mm. It's a remarkable story, and from Brian, and thanks for coming in, and thanks for sharing it with us, and all the very best with Strongman.
Thank you.
That's all we have for this very poignant episode. Thanks for listening, and thanks again to the incredibly inspiring Ephraim Brynan. Remember, you can stay connected with Ephraim and learn more about the charity Strongmen by visiting strongmen.org.uk. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast for more inspiring conversations with a whole range of different guests, from current players to coaching staff to legends from the past and much more in between. We'll see you next time.
The official Brighton and Hove Albion podcast. Sports Social Podcast Network.